Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Joe Donahue in for Ray Graff. Here on this Medical Monday, we discuss neurosurgery. Dr. Alexandra Paul is with us of Albany Medical Center, a graduate of Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Dr. Paul specializes in endovascular and microsurgical neurosurgery for the treatment of a variety of cerebrovascular, is that
correct?
Is that the correct pronunciation of that word? And we're going to talk about all of that stuff. We welcome your calls. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-34-TALK-1. Dr. Paul, welcome to the program. How are you?
Wonderful. Thank you for having me.
It's very nice to have you on the show. How are things going in the world, in your world of neurosurgery?
Things are going wonderfully. We just started using a new app, which is called VizAI, which uses some artificial intelligence to predict what we call large vessel occlusions, which is one of the causes of stroke that we're able to do a surgery on to help patients and help reverse some of the stroke symptoms.
So you use the app or the patient uses the app?
The hospitals use the app.
Okay, all right. And how does that work?
So the patients go to a smaller stroke center and they're able to have a CAT scan done there. And that CAT scan is sent directly to our phones. And if there's an alert, if the artificial intelligence predicts that there is a large vessel occlusion, we get an alert on our phone and we're able to tell the outside hospital to send the patient to us for a possible surgery.
So that is fascinating. I mean, that seems to be really cool for all parties involved.
Right. I think it's most important, wonderfully, for the patients. And then also it helps the outside hospitals create a channel of communication directly with us. And it's been really wonderful to see.
What can go wrong in that? Are there things of the accuracy of it?
So the artificial intelligence sometimes has a hard time picking up on smaller occlusions, but we're able to look at the whole scan ourselves on our phone. And so even if the artificial intelligence doesn't recognize the occlusion, as a physician, we're able to go through the scan and pick it up as well.
We welcome your phone calls as we talk about neurosurgery on Vox Pop this afternoon. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1, 1-800-348-2551. You can also reach us via email, voxpop@wamc.org. So when it comes to day-to-day, what is, in your personal day-to-day profession, how many do you see patients most of the day?
So 2 days a week I'm in the outpatient setting seeing patients in clinic.
Yep.
1 day a week I'm in the operating room.
Yep.
And then 1 or 2 days a week I'm in the angio suite doing endovascular interventions.
The best explanation of neurosurgery is what?
Operating on the brain and the spinal cord.
Yeah. And so that right there strikes fear, I think, in most people that if anything's screwed up there, oh God, you know, what that the things aren't going to be good.
Certainly doing what we do is a privilege.
Yeah. So when, but what I just said is not necessarily true. It in the sense that the success rate has skyrocketed if you compare it to 30, 40 years ago.
Correct. So there are kind of two different scenarios. One scenario is we're operating on a patient who is already neurologically normal, so they don't have any neurologic deficit.
Yes.
And for example, a patient with an unruptured aneurysm that comes in for treatment, the chances of that patient having a stroke or a catastrophic event are extremely, extremely low, probably less than 1%. And that has certainly improved over time. The second scenario is a patient who suffered a neurologic problem and comes in with some weakness from a tumor or from a ruptured aneurysm. And in those cases, sometimes we can help actually reverse that neurologic deficit. So they may even see some improvement after surgery.
We welcome your phone calls on Vox Pop this afternoon, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1. We go to Jim. Good afternoon. How are you?
Hey, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I got kind of a weird one here.
Great.
Can bad teeth cause poor vision or blindness through the ophthalmic branch of the trigeminal nerve?
All right. Can bad teeth cause bad vision or blindness because of the reason he mentioned, which I'm not going to repeat because I wouldn't get it right.
So certainly oral hygiene has been connected to visual health as well, particularly in things like glaucoma. There has been a strong connection with oral hygiene. However, I am not aware of any connection of the ophthalmic division of the trigeminal nerve being implicated in bad vision from oral hygiene.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim. Appreciate the telephone call. Let's go to Dan now in Clifton Park, New York. Dan, go ahead.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
I have a question. My sister had a stroke about 10 years ago, and she had the clot buster. She had some recovery but significant impairment on her left side. And I was wondering, is anything currently in the path where they might be able to do surgery to break the clot and restore some brain function? Or is anything coming down the road that might be, like clinical trials?
Hi, Dan. I'm sorry to hear about your sister. I'm glad to hear she's recovering some. So the procedure that I'm speaking about actually is exactly that. It's a newer procedure where we're able to go inside the blood vessels and try to remove the clot from the brain. So not just relying on the clot-busting medication to work through an IV, but physically we're putting catheters and wires up into the blood vessels of the brain to try to retrieve that clot. And there have been multiple clinical trials really since 2015 that have shown tremendous benefit in that procedure.
Wow, that's fantastic. And she had in 2013, and Albany Med said surgery wouldn't be possible because of the location of the clot.
Right.
Do you think that should be re-looked at?
Well, certainly there are some times where we're not able to do the procedure based on where the clot is, but that procedure generally needs to be done. We prefer to do it within 6 hours, but certainly within 24 hours of the patient developing symptoms.
Oh, okay. So it's probably unlikely, being over 10 years old, that this event had occurred, that it could be resolved.
Correct.
Surgically?
So the clot in the brain would be unlikely to be amenable to any surgical procedure if they found she had the stroke because of some narrowing of the blood vessels in the neck, like carotid stenosis. Certainly that would be something she could be eligible for a procedure for. But for the procedure that I'm talking about with the wires and the catheters into the brain, that really has to be done in the acute setting of the stroke.
One additional question.
Sure.
Is there any studies being done regarding clinical trials and stem cells for strokes?
I'm sure that there are, but none that I am very familiar with.
Yep. Thank you so much. I appreciate your answers.
Dan, best of luck to you and to your sister. Thank you very much for the telephone call. That frees up a line for you, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-34-TALK-1. Dr. Paul is with us this afternoon. We are talking about neurosurgery on this Medical Monday edition of Vox Pop. You can join us, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1. You can also join us by writing to us, voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Vox Pop Medical Monday on this, yes, appropriately, Monday. We're talking neurosurgery today. Dr. Alexandra Paul is with us of the Albany Medical Center, and we welcome you and your phone calls, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1. You can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org. Let's go back to the calls. We go to Christine in Malta. Christine, go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Chris, thank you so much. I'd love to, like, wax poetic with the doctor about the pineal gland just for giggles. But
Well, don't we all?
No. Right. Every night we go to bed thinking the same thing. But my quick question is, without burdening with you, is like, what insurance covers that app that is a pre, you know, a potential avoidance of having a stroke? You know, because the answer is, of course, it depends. But what do I say to my primary care physician who is actually on my insurance, you know, barring like stores of cash that I can put towards this endeavor? What do I say to my physician's assistant to encourage her to allow me this, you know, this experience of having this app? I've got a history of stroke in my family, you know, and I can just imagine. She's going to be like, well, right. You know, have you had a mini stroke yet? You know, it's like, so how does one advocate in the current healthcare situation to your doctor to have this test done?
So the good news is that you don't need to worry about that at all. This app is only used in the emergency room, and it's paid for by the hospital. So the app does not care what insurance you have. It has no idea what your insurance status is. And so if you came to the emergency room with symptoms of a stroke and had a CT scan at the hospital, it would automatically be uploaded to this application because it's paid for by the hospital systems. In terms of prevention of stroke, we don't have an app for that yet, but we do know the most important things to reduce your stroke risk are smoking cessation, exercise, eating a healthy diet, stress management, and getting good sleep, all of which are very difficult to do, but those are the most important things to reduce the risk of you having a stroke.
Thank you very much, Christine, for your telephone call. We appreciate it. That frees the line for you, 1-800-348-2551. I have some Vox Pop letters that went to email as well that I want to get to. But before we do, you mentioned this in the previous call about that window of opportunity. Talk a little bit about that window, what we know of that window, and how I assume it changes from patient to patient.
Exactly. So what we know about that window is it's different for every patient. And so Every patient has different blood flow to the brain. And some patients can tolerate a blocked vessel for only a few minutes. And some patients can tolerate it for up to 24 hours. And so we don't go just based on a time frame alone. But certainly the brain loses millions of neurons every minute during one of these blockages. And so the faster, the better. But there's not a set time.
All right. Let's go to some of the letters that we got through email. And again, it's voxpop@wamc.org. From Sam in Saratoga, does Dr. Paul have any recommendations for general brain health, i.e. diet, brain strengthening activities, etc.? How do we exercise the brain, Doctor?
So certainly there's a huge connection between diet and brain health. There are many different theories on what the best diet is, but probably a Mediterranean style diet or a vegetable heavy diet is very healthy for your brain in reducing the stroke risk. Games like the Lumosity app or even simple Sudoku can certainly help help your brain and help prevent Alzheimer's as well.
All right, let's go to this letter from another listener, and that is, well, actually, while I do find the letter I'm looking for, let's go to Charles, who joins us. Good morning, Charles. You're from Lake Katrine. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, it's my understanding that Lyme disease is a spirochete that attacks the nervous system. And quite a few ways, especially brain fog, and loss of vision, muscle cramps, and I don't know, does it attack the vagus nerve, causing disruption of the digestive system, constipation, a whole variety of things, and what a neurosurgeon's approach to Lyme disease would be.
So Lyme disease is certainly a very complicated disease. Unfortunately, that really is best treated by a neurologist and not a neurosurgeon. So I don't have very much to comment on that.
All right. Charles, thank you very much for the telephone call. We check in with Christine in Waterville. My question, how is neurological functioning affected by heart disease?
That's a good question. So we do know that the same factors that cause coronary artery disease or plaque in the heart similarly affect the blood vessels of the brain. And so they are very often related in that patients who have heart disease also often have narrowing of the blood vessels of the brain or intracranial stenosis. Also, some patients with heart disease have poor heart function and are not able to pump enough blood to the brain, and that may affect their cognitive status as well.
All right, let's go to Francis in East Greenbush. Francis, go ahead.
Hi. I have a frontoparietal parasagittal convexity meningioma.
It's, I just have to know, did you know that off the top of your head, or was that on a card in front of you?
No.
You read that.
From the MRI report.
Okay, all right. Thank God.
So it measures, at the biggest measurement, it's 3.5 millimeters, or would that be centimeters? You would know that.
Centimeters. Most likely it's centimeters.
And it's, okay, yes, that's what it is. It's located near a blood vessel. I am wondering if there is a way to, or are there doctors doing this, an endovascular embolization to destroy the tumor rather than doing a craniotomy and going that type of surgery, or would it still, if it was embolized, would it still have to be removed through using a craniotomy?
So that's a very good question. We do embolization of meningiomas. Basically, what that involves is bringing a small catheter up to the blood vessels of the brain that are feeding the meningioma and injecting particles to help kill off the blood supply to that meningioma. That is usually done in concert with open surgery or a craniotomy. And so generally we do the embolization a few days before the open surgery. And the goal of the embolization is to help reduce the blood loss from the surgery. Embolization alone would likely not be enough to treat the meningioma. In the location that you're mentioning, this parasagittal location, sometimes we can also do an endovascular procedure to stent open the vein that you're mentioning, the superior sagittal sinus, if it looks like it's narrowed by the tumor. Again, without seeing the pictures or knowing, you know, about your medical history, it's hard for me to comment directly, but there certainly are some endovascular options depending on, you know, your surgeon and kind of what their thoughts were.
Okay. When you say inject particles, are those radioactive particles?
No, they are not. They are just occlusive to the blood vessels, and so they cause necrosis or the tumor to die. We haven't done any radioactive particles to the brain. They do it to the liver for some cancers, but we have not done it to the brain yet.
Okay.
Francis, we wish you well, and thank you very much for the telephone call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the information.
You're welcome.
We welcome your call. We're talking about neurology on Vox Pop this afternoon, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1. Again, that's 1-800-348-2551. You can email us as well, voxpop@wamc.org. That is what Kathy did, and I'm gonna help you here. I'm going to need your help, Doctor. Kathy from Albany, I have trigeminal, is that
trigeminal?
Right? Trigeminal. Neuralgia V1 right side with MRI positive for venous compression, venous. Thank you. How frequently does AMC neurosurgery do microvascular decompression surgeries for this? Do you have a surgeon who specializes in this? And how about many per month, year would the specialist be doing?
So did you say Kathy?
Kathy, yes.
What Kathy is talking about is a condition called trigeminal neuralgia, which I think most people have heard of, and generally involves shooting pain in the face. The This can sometimes be caused by one of the blood vessels of the brain putting pressure on the trigeminal nerve, which it sounds like Kathy has an MRI that confirmed that finding. Sometimes we can do a surgery to place some material between the artery and the nerve to give the nerve some more space and some room to heal to prevent that pain. We do that procedure frequently at Albany Medical Center, and I'm happy to get Kathy's email afterwards and I can connect her with a surgeon who does that procedure. Trigeminal neuralgia is not that common in the population, but I would say we do that approach for other surgeries in this area for some other kinds of tumors like acoustic neuromas. And so we're very comfortable with the approach, and we've done the surgery for trigeminal neuralgia many times as well.
Yeah, I'm reading into this of asking about how frequently the operation is done, but I assume that's a good question to ask. I assume what she's asking there, it's not so much a scheduling question, but they will do it as it's necessary, but to know how much experience the surgeon has in that particular.
Correct. That was what I took from the email.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Excellent. We welcome your letters, which you can send to us via email. It's voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. You can also give us a shout. Call us 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1. How much of all of this, I guess my interest in stroke is my mother was the youngest of three women, and all three died of stroke. And so the family history, I assume, in that sense is very important.
Yes, yes.
And how much can that then be altered?
So there are certain risk factors that we know you're not able to modify, like your family history.
Yeah.
But we do know that there are a majority of risk factors that can be modified. And so I think in that situation, with such a strong history of family history of stroke, kind of focusing on the risk factors that can be modified can help.
And in some of the other things that we're talking about today, and I guess just in your profession in general, that family history plays a role or can.
Yes. We always are asking about family history, also with aneurysm ruptures and not just stroke.
Yeah.
But for a lot of neurologic problems.
And then again, the earlier you get to it, the better as far as knowing what's
exactly
going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you determine that in the through the process? I mean, last week we were talking about heart disease. We had a cardiologist on, and one of the things that we kept on saying is, you know, the earlier you get to us, the better. However, most people don't arrive early. They arrive when problems are presented. I assume it's the same for you.
It's very similar. Patients tend to ignore signs of stroke or brush it off, probably because they're scared and they want to pretend it didn't happen. But a TIA is a warning sign. So any neurologic deficit that happens for less than 24 hours and completely resolves is technically a transient ischemic attack. And that's a big warning sign that something's going on.
We welcome your calls, 1-800-348-2551. We have lines open. We go to Donna in Saratoga Springs. Donna, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
At the tender age of 25, I was struck out of the blue with optic neuritis in one of my eyes. It's frightening. I woke up and could barely see. So I rushed to the doctor. They treated it with steroids, an ophthalmologist did, and I regained most of my vision. I cannot see the color red well out of that eye. It looks more like a faded orange. And I have a donut of clarity from several field vision tests, which I've had done since. Any idea where this came out of? And God forbid, I'm not going to get it in the other eye, am I? Because then I'll be legally blind.
So optic neuritis generally just means inflammation of the nerve, the optic nerve. Sometimes that can be associated with conditions like multiple sclerosis. You haven't had any problems since you lost the vision in your eye?
Oh, that's true. They tested me for lupus, MS. They did all these. I had a spinal tap.
Yeah.
They checked me for every neurological disease they could think of.
So I think the good news with that is that most likely it's very unlikely to happen in the other eye. If it didn't seem like you had any other systemic cause for the optic neuritis, it is possible it may have just been due to a viral infection or some other kind of inflammation of the optic nerve. But if MS was ruled out, then I think the chance of it happening on the other side is pretty unlikely.
Donna.
Okay. There's no fixing the optic nerve.
No, unfortunately, we haven't found a way to do that yet.
Donna, thank you very much for the telephone call. I think we can sneak in one more call here before we go to a break. Richard is in Schenectady. Richard, go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah. Hi, Richard. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. I have a pulsating feeling in my forehead. It seems to be a little, if I run up the stairs, it's a little bit more. I haven't been to the doctor yet. It just happened today.
I mean, the easy answer, and I'm not a doctor, would be don't run up the stairs. But, doctor, what would you recommend?
Is it a headache, or can you describe it a little bit more?
No, it's not painful. It feels like an artery pulsating, and I feel that area. I can't feel anything. It feels like an artery that's pulsating. That's all I can say. It's not painful. It's just...
And you've had it before?
No.
Oh, okay.
I would probably recommend that you make an appointment with your physician. If you're not having any pain, I think it's unlikely to be something worrisome. There is a big artery that feeds the scalp that sometimes patients do feel pulsating in their forehead. But if it's something that persists, I certainly, it's hard to make any kind of comment without being able to examine you.
Yeah. Richard brings up an interesting point, though, because, we were just talking about it right before we took his call about getting there early and figuring out what to do. And yet, if you react, and I'm not saying that's the case here, but if you react to every, weird thing your body does in any given time, you'd be in the emergency room of the doctor's office every 3 days.
Correct. So that is why we do have the acronym BFAST, which is to warn patients about the worrisome signs of stroke. And so the B stands for balance, the E stands for eyes, any change in your vision, the F is for face, any weakness in the face, the A is for arm, any weakness in the arm or the leg. And the S stands for speech, any trouble with your speech. And then the T is for time. It's important to get there quickly. And so I would say if anyone has any of those warning signs, those are emergencies, and that should be evaluated right away.
We are going to take a break, and we welcome you to join us. It's Medical Monday on Vox Pop this afternoon, and we are very pleased to be discussing neurosurgery with Dr. Alexandra Paul of Albany Medical Center. We welcome your calls, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also join us via email, voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. The final 19 minutes and 12 seconds of our program will proceed right after this. Welcome back to Medical Monday. I'm Vox Pop. This afternoon, we are talking about neurosurgery, and we have a wonderful guest, Dr. Alexandra Paul of Albany Medical Center, joining us this afternoon, and I've been talking about a wide range of issues. Some fascinating questions from listeners. We welcome yours, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1. So that when I say that is if you look at the word talk, and you have one of those phones that has the letters under it, that would be TALK, and that would also be 8255. That's what it is, talk one. Okay. We welcome you. You can also write to us. It's voxpop@wamc.org. Charlotte is in Kingston, New York, joining us on line one. Good morning or good afternoon, Charlotte. How are you?
Good afternoon. Should I start?
You should start. Yes, please do.
Okay. All right. I was diagnosed with a aneurysm on the carotid artery over my left eye And when I went in for the surgery, they told me that they were going to be putting a stent in, and they went in through my wrist, which was a relatively just a few year old procedure. And when they got up to the carotid artery and that area, they saw that it was not an aneurysm, but it was a shadow from a meningioma that was sitting on my left optic nerve. And they came back out. I woke up from the surgery, and they told me I had great arteries, but I have no aneurysm. And the meningioma needs to be watched on a regular basis, like at least initially every year and then every couple of years, and that it was also hereditary, which I had no idea that meningiomas were hereditary. But when I checked with my cousins, three of my cousins had meningiomas in different areas. And I guess I'm asking is, what is the prognosis for something like that, where I have an meningioma sitting in a place that's not really operable because it's right on the right above the optic nerve on the left side, and it's the carotid artery. So it's worrisome. I mean, I'm going to go have a MRI next week. It's a year since I was diagnosed with it, but it's kind of scary to me.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It's always scary. The good news is that meningiomas are generally benign tumors, which means they don't spread anywhere else in the body. And it sounds like you would have a few treatment options if it were to grow. The majority of meningiomas, however, don't grow. They stay the same size. And I follow many meningiomas every year that never change. And so most likely the meningioma will stay the same size. If it does show some evidence of growth, you would have the option of possibly doing radiation for it, based on what I'm hearing, it sounds like the location. And so I think overall, you kind of received some good news from that procedure, that you didn't have an aneurysm. And I think the safe thing is to follow the meningioma with MRIs to see if it's changing or not.
Right, because I did see both a neurosurgeon and a surgeon that works with what you were just talking about, where radiation.
Yeah.
And he explained to me, because it's so close to the optic nerve on the left side, radiation, well, both surgeries would be a little risky because of the vision on the left eye. And so they said the best hope is that it's not going to grow and it's going to be fine. And the worst thing that could happen is I could lose vision in my left eye. I mean, it's not a happy diagnosis, but the hope is that nothing will happen. He said you could have an meningioma for 30 years and nothing happened.
Hmm. Right. And a lot of people have these and don't even know about them. And so I think it's great that you found out and you can proactively monitor it, you know, and catch it early if anything does change.
Charlotte, we're thinking of you, and we wish you all... Go ahead.
You.
No, go ahead. Did you have more?
No, I just, you know, it's scary to think that I have something like that, and I'm happy to think that it's not going to hurt me. So, but I just wanted to hear somebody else say that as well.
Yeah, I want as many people to tell me it's not going to hurt me as well. Charlotte, thank you very much. We appreciate your phone call, and we wish you all the luck in the world. Susan writes to us and says, in March, I had an episode that caused optic neuropathy. After many MRIs, CAT scans, spirals, blood tests, megasteroid doses, etc., there seems to be no conclusive idea of the cause, nor has my vision gotten any better. It seems it is thought to be a lack of blood flow event, not from an infection. Doctor, any thoughts?
No, unfortunately, it sounds like a pretty thorough workup. And without being able to see any of the tests or the imaging, I'm not sure I have much to add.
All right. Thank you very much for the letter. We welcome yours. Foxpop at WAMC.org. Foxpop at WAMC.org. Go to Diane in Pittsfield, yep. Massachusetts. Hi, Diane. How are you?
Hi. How are you?
Fine. Thank you. Go ahead.
Good. Yes, thank you. I just wanted to discuss the optic neuritis in my left eye.
Right.
I've had multiple sclerosis for over 30 years, and the optic neuritis in my left eye was the first sign of it. I just wanted to try and help you educate everybody on it. If any symptoms like that pops up when your eye's blurriness, go to your doctor right away, because there is, as the physician there kindly said, there is no cure for it, but it can be monitored. And fortunately, my optic neuritis has stayed the same over the 30 years I've had it. I've had other MS symptoms, but my eye has been okay. So I just wanted to kind of add that in today and help educate people on it.
Always good. Thank you very much. The customer reviews are always good, right? I mean, they always help prime the pump, I think.
I think you probably need an ophthalmologist as your next guest also. A lot of eye questions.
we'll get Ray on that. Ed is with us from Poughkeepsie. Hi, Ed.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Mine is more of a neuroscientific nature than a neurosurgical nature, but I'm sure the guest has opinions in neuroscience. And I'm interested in the, generally speaking, two competing models of the brain. The brain is a receptive organ or whatever from stimuli coming in and getting organized, and the brain is a spontaneous organ where it is spontaneously and to a considerable degree innately shaping the perceptions as they come in. Associated with the latter theory would be people like Mouzaki and Changeau, the French neuroscientist. I'm just wondering if our guest has any opinion on those two somewhat competing models of the brain.
Let me check with our guest and I'll get back to you. Go ahead.
So I think, you know, certainly we could spend hours talking about this. I personally tend to think of the brain more as a receptive model, but I think it's probably ultimately a combination of both.
Deborah, thank you very much for the telephone call. Let's go to Howard now from New Paltz. Howard, go ahead.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
I have two things I want to bring up. Have you ever heard of or used hyperbaric chambers?
I've certainly heard of them, but I have not used them.
What is it? I'm sorry.
It's amazing to me how there's something that could be so powerful for people who have heart problems or blood flow problems or lack of oxygen, that a chamber that can actually fill your whole body with oxygen can be very beneficial to the brain, especially, and the heart. Why do they not use it?
So a hyperbaric chamber is basically a chamber filled with pressurized oxygen. And so it is used for some things like some wound healing problems, some burns, occasionally if there's some air embolus, but we don't use them generally in neurosurgery.
All right. Thank you very much for the telephone call. To Pittsfield we go. Joe is on the line. Joe, go ahead.
Hi, Joe. I'm on the panel now with Dr. Paul, right?
Yes,
I have a question regarding medication. I have a question regarding medication. I had a stent implant in the past, and I was prescribed Plavix and an aspirin. Subsequent to that, I developed a subdural hematoma. Ended up in the hospital for 7 days, and I had to be weaned off the Plavix. And eventually, they did the evacuation of the hematoma, and I was sent back to my room and ended up having seizures. I was told later that I was supposed to have been administered Dilantin, and I want to know if that's the best practice after having a subdural hematoma evacuation.
Hi, Joe. So what Joe's describing is a subdural hematoma, which is a collection of blood in between the skull and the brain. Sometimes these are chronic, which means it's older collection, which happened from a past trauma or fall. And sometimes they're acute, which means it's newer, fresher blood. And usually the acute subdurals are more of an emergency. And the chronic subdurals generally can be done after someone weans off their medication. Sometimes we do prescribe anti-seizure medication, such as Keppra or Dilantin, after surgery, but I don't know the specifics of this case or am able to see any of the CAT scans, so it's very difficult for me to comment on the standard of care.
Joe, thank you very much for the telephone call. Just have a few minutes left and time for one or two more calls or letters. It's voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. You can also call us 1-800-348-2551. We go to Watervliet, where Dale is with us. Good afternoon, Dale.
Oh, good afternoon. My question is, in the case of cervical stenosis causing numbness in both hands, what should be done before surgery is considered?
Hi, Dale. So sometimes narrowing of the spinal canal in the neck can cause cervical myelopathy, which it sounds like you're describing, where patients get numbness in their hands, sometimes have trouble using their hands or dropping objects, and may have trouble walking.
Yeah.
Sometimes there is no real medical treatment for cervical stenosis, so the ultimate treatment is surgery to try to increase the room for the spinal cord. But not every patient needs surgery. Sometimes this can stabilize over time, but there's not really a good medicine or other treatment. Really, it's just monitoring the symptoms and seeing how things are progressing.
What does the surgery actually consist of?
So that would depend on what your MRI looks like. Sometimes we can do surgery from the front of the neck, and sometimes we do surgery from the back of the neck, depending on where it looks like you have the narrowing.
Does that help you out, Dale?
What are the possible consequences of choosing not to have surgery?
So, again, it would depend on how severe your MRI looks and how severe your symptoms are now. So I think that is probably a better question for the surgeon who has seen you in the office.
Dale, thanks very much for the telephone call. Let's see. I think we can get one more call in here before the end of the program, maybe two. Claire is in Lakeville, Connecticut. Go, Claire.
Hi, I will try to be concise. 5 years ago, my then 28-year-old healthy son with no risk factors woke up with a headache, which progressed over the course of 2 days to nausea, vomiting, dizziness, double vision. It turned out he had a cerebellar hemorrhage, which was evacuated, and he had the diagnosis of a cavernous malformation. And something that's never been clear to me is the difference between a cavernous malformation and an aneurysm and a stroke, and I'm wondering if you could just help clarify for me.
Sure. So the term stroke can be a bit confusing because the American Heart Association has classified many different pathologies or problems all as stroke. And so there are bleeding kinds of strokes and then ischemic or lack of oxygen kinds of strokes. And so generally, when we talk about stroke, we mean the kind where the brain's not getting enough oxygen. But many kinds of
due to a clot
or to some other reason, right? But many times bleeding in the brain is also classified technically as a stroke. And so sounds like your son had some bleeding in the brain, and so technically that would be considered a stroke.
Okay, I guess maybe they did not use that word because they thought it would alarm me. I'm not sure.
Right, yeah.
But thankfully he's doing very well now.
Good, I'm glad to hear that.
There's that kind of... Yeah, he was active duty Air Force at the time, and he was overseas, so that further complicated things.
Yeah.
But an
aneurysm is a weak spot in the wall of a blood vessel, like a bubble on a tire that can rupture. A cavernous malformation is an abnormal collection of usually very thin-walled blood vessels, which can bleed, but bleed less frequently than aneurysms can rupture. And generally, when cavernous malformations bleed, it's not fatal. Like in the case of your son, he was able to get to the hospital and to have surgery. And so those are some of the differences.
Claire, thank you very much for the telephone call. We appreciate it. Let's see. I've got 30 seconds. Colin, do you think we can help you in 30 seconds?
Maybe real quick. I was diagnosed I had a case of shingles when I was in college. I continued to have nerve pain where the rash broke out. Anything you can give me on that?
So I would really recommend that you see a good neurologist or pain management doctor. There are some good nerve-modifying agents like Lyrica or gabapentin that may be helpful. But again, probably a neurologist would be the best person to see.
Thanks very much for the telephone call. A lot of letters and calls we didn't get to. My apologies to those folks. We are out of time. Thanks, of course, goes to Dr. Alexandra Paul from Albany Medical Center for joining us this afternoon. Thank you so much, Dr. Paul. What a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you
for having me.
Support for Vox Pop comes from Drs. Sarcino and McGuire, podiatrists with offices in Greenwich, New York, and Bennington, Vermont. Surgery for the foot and ankle, nyfootsurge.com for more information. Thanks again for joining us today on Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. I'm Joe Donahue. Tomorrow it's Birds with Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart.
Stay tuned now for The Media Project.